Chapter 40. They pulled him shivering from the open womb of the casket. He felt like a man who had been rescued from drowning in winter. The faces of the people around him sharpened into focus, but he did not recognize any of them immediately. Someone threw a quilted thermal blanket around the narrow frame of his shoulders. They eyed him without speaking, guessing that he was in no mood for conversation and would wish instead to orientate himself by his own efforts. Clavain sat on the edge of the casket for several minutes until he had enough strength in his legs to hobble across the chamber. He stumbled at the last moment, and yet made the fall appear graceful, as if he had intended to lean suddenly against the support of the porthole's armored frame. He peered through the glass. He could see nothing beyond except blackness, with his own ghastly reflection hovering in the foreground. He appeared strangely eyeless, his sockets crammed with shadows which were the precise black of the background vacuum. He felt a savage jolt of déjà vu, the feeling that he had been here before, contemplating his own mask-like face. He tugged and nagged at the thread of memory until it spooled free, recalling a last-minute diplomatic mission, a shuttle falling towards occupied Mars, an imminent confrontation with an old enemy and friend called Galliana. And he remembered that even then, 400 years ago, though it was more now, he thought, he had felt too old for the world, too old for the role it forced upon him. Had he known what lay before him then, he would have either laughed or gone insane. It had felt like the end of his life, and yet it had been only a moment from its beginning, barely separable in his memories now from his childhood. He looked back at the people who had brought him around and then up at the ceiling. "Dim the lights," someone said. His reflection disappeared. Now he could see something other than blackness. It was a swarm of stars, squashed into one hemisphere of the sky, reds and blues and golds and frigid whites. Some were brighter than others, though he saw no familiar constellations. But the clumping of the stars, stirred into one part of the sky, meant only one thing. They were still moving relativistically, still skimming near the speed of light. Clavain turned back to the small huddle of people. "Has the battle taken place?" A pale, dark-haired woman spoke for the group. "Yes, Clavain." She spoke warmly, but not with the absolute assurance Clavain had expected. "Yes, it's over. We engaged the trio of conjoiner ships, destroying one and damaging the other two."
"Only damaged?"
"The simulations didn't get it quite right," said the woman. She moved to Clavain's side and pushed a beaker of brown fluid under his nose. He looked at her face and hair. There was something familiar about the way she wore it, something that sparked the same ancient memories that had been stirred by his reflection in the porthole. "Here, drink this. Recuperative medicines from Ilya's arsenal. It'll do you the world of good." Clavain took the beaker from the woman's hand and sniffed at the broth. It smelt of chocolate, when he had expected tea. He tipped some down his throat.
"Thank you," he said. "Do you mind if I ask your name?"
"Not at all," the woman said. "I'm Felka. You know me quite well." He looked at her and shrugged.
"You seem familiar.
Drink up. I think you need it." His memory came back in swathes, like a city recovering from a power failure, block by random block, utilities shuttering and flickering before normal service was resumed. Even when he felt all right, there came other medicine therapies, each of which dealt with specific areas of brain function, each of which was administered in doses more carefully tuned than the last, while Clavain grimaced and cooperated with the minimum of good grace. By the end of it, he did not want to see another thimbleful of chocolate in his life. After several hours, he was deemed to be neurologically sound. There were still things that he did not recall with great precision, but he was told this was within the error margins of the usual amnesia that accompanied reefer sleep fugue and did not indicate any untoward lapses. They gave him a lightweight biomonitor tabard, assigned a spindly bronze servitor to him, and told him he was free to move around as he pleased.
"Shouldn't I be asking why you've woken me?" he said. "We'll get to that later," said Scorpio,
who seemed to be in charge.
"There's no immediate hurry, Clavain.
But I take it there's a decision that needs to be made." Scorpio glanced at one of the other leaders, the woman called Antoinette Bax. She had wide eyes and a freckled nose, and he felt that there were memories of her that he had yet to unearth. She nodded back, almost imperceptibly.
"We wouldn't have woken you for the view, Clavaine," Scorpio said. "It's a piece of crap, even with the lights out."
Somewhere in the heart of the immense vessel was a place that felt like it belonged in some entirely different part of the universe. It was a glade, a place of grass and trees and synthetic blue skies. There were holographic birds in the air, parrots and hornbills and such like, skimming from tree to tree in comet-like flashes of bright primary color. And there was a waterfall in the distance, which looked suspiciously real, hazed in a swirling talcum-blue mist, where it emptied into a small dark lake. Felka escorted Clavaine onto a flat apron of cool, glistening grass. She wore a long, black dress, her feet lost under the black spillage of the hem. She did not seem to mind it dragging through the dew-laden grass. They sat down facing each other, resting on tree stumps whose tops had been polished to mirrored smoothness. They had the place to themselves, except for the birds. Clavaine looked around. He felt much better now, and his memory was nearly whole. But he did not remember this place at all.
"Did you create this, Felka?"
"No," she said cautiously. "But why do you ask?"
"Because it reminds me a little of the forest at the core of the Mother Nest, I suppose, where you had your atelier. Except it has gravity, of course, which your atelier didn't."
"So you do remember, then?" He scratched at the stubble on his chin. Someone had thoughtfully shaved off his beard when he was asleep.
"Dribs and drabs. Not as much of what happened before I went under as I'd like."
"What do you remember exactly?"
"Remontoire leaving to make contact with Sylvestre. You almost going with him, and then deciding not to. Not much else. Volyova's dead, isn't she?"
Felka nodded. "We got the planet evacuated. You and Volyova agreed to split the remaining Hell-class weapons. She took Stormbird, loaded as many weapons onto it as she could manage, and rode it straight into the heart of the inhibitor machine." Clavaine pursed his lips and whistled quietly.
"Did she make much difference?"
"None at all. But she went out with a bang." Clavaine smiled.
"I never expected anything less of her. And what else?"
"Curry and Thorn, you remember them? They joined Remontoire's expedition to Hades. They have shuttles, and they've initiated zodiacal light self-repair systems. All they have to do is keep supplying it with raw material, and it will repair itself. But it will take a little while. Time enough for them to make contact with Sylvestre, Curry thinks."
"I don't know quite what to make of her claim to have already been into Hades," Clavaine said,
picking blades of grass from the area around his feet. He crushed them and sniffed the pulpy green residue that stained his fingers.
"But the Triumvir seemed to think it was true."
"We'll find out sooner or later," Felka said. "After they've made contact, however long that takes, they'll take zodiacal light out of the system and follow our trajectory. As for us, well, it's still your ship, Clavaine. But day-to-day affairs are handled by a triumvirate. Triumvirs, Blood, Cruz, and Scorpio, by popular vote. Curry would be one of them, of course, if she hadn't chosen to stay behind after the evacuation."
"My memory says they rescued 160,000 people, Clavaine said. "Is that shockingly wide of the mark?"
"No, it's about right. Which sounds pretty impressive until you realize that we didn't manage to save 40,000 others.
We were the thing that went wrong, weren't we? If we hadn't intervened..."
"No, Clavaine." Her voice was admonitionary, as if he was an old man who had committed some awful faux pas in polite company. "No. You mustn't think like that. Look, it was like this, understand?" They were close enough for conjoined thought. She piped images into his head, pictures from the death of Resurgam. He saw the last hours of the Wolf Machine. That was what they were now all calling the inhibitor weapon. Bored its gravitation sinkhole into the very heart of the star, stabbing an invisible curette deep into the nuclear burning core. The tunnel that it had opened was exceedingly narrow, no more than a few kilometers wide at its deepest point. And though the star was being drained of blood, the process was no uncontrolled hemorrhage. Instead, the fusing matter in the nuclear-burning core was allowed to squirt out in a fine jetting arc, a column of expanding, cooling hellfire, that speared from the star's surface at half the speed of light. Constrained and guided by pulses of the same gravitational energy that had caught the star in the first place, the spike was bent in a lazy parabola that caused it to douse against the dayside of Resurgam. By the time it impacted, the starfire flame was 1,000 kilometers across. The effect was catastrophic and practically instantaneous. The atmosphere was boiled away in a searing flash, the ice caps and the few areas of open water following instants later. Arid and airless, the crust under the beam became molten, the spike gouging a cherry-red scar across the face of the planet. Hundreds of vertical kilometers of the planet's surface were incinerated, gouting into space in a hot cloud of boiled rock. Shockwaves from the initial impact reached around the world and destroyed all life on the night side, every human being, every organism that humans had brought to Resurgam. And yet they would have died soon enough without that shockwave. Within hours, the night side had turned to face the sun. The spike continued to boil, the well of the energy at the heart of the star barely tapped. Resurgam's crust burned away, and still the beam continued to chew into the planet's mantle. It took 3 weeks to reduce the planet to a smoking red-hot cinder, 4/5 of its previous size. Then the beam flicked to another target, another world, and began the same murderous sweep. The depletion of matter from the star's heart would eventually bleed Delta Pavonis down to a cool husk of itself, until so much matter had been removed that fusion came to an abrupt halt. It had not happened yet, Felker said, at least not according to the light signals that were catching up with them from the system. But when it did, it stood every chance of being a violent event.
So you see, Felker said, we were actually lucky to rescue as many as we did. It wasn't our fault that more died. We just did what was right under the circumstances. There's no sense feeling guilty about it. If we hadn't shown up, 1,000 other things could have gone wrong. Skade's fleet would still have arrived, and she wouldn't have been any more inclined to negotiate than you were.
Clavain remembered the vile flash of a dying starship, and remembered also the ultimate death of Galliana that he had sanctioned with the decision to destroy Nightshade. Even now the thought of that was painful. Skade died. Didn't she? I killed her in interstellar space. The other elements of her fleet were acting autonomously, even when we engaged them.
Everything was autonomous, Felker said with curious evasion.
Clavain watched a macaw orbit from tree to tree. I don't mind being consulted on strategic matters, but I'm not seeking a position of authority on this ship. It isn't mine, for a start, no matter what Volyova might have thought. I'm too old to take command. And besides, what would the ship need with me anyway? It already has its own captain.
Felker's voice was low. So you remember the captain?
I remember what Volyova told us. I don't remember ever talking with the captain himself. Is he still running things, the way she said he would?
Her voice remained guarded. Depends what you mean by running things. His infrastructure is still intact. But there's been no sign of him as a conscious entity since we left Delta Pavonis.
Then the captain's dead? Is that it?
No, that can't be it either. He had fingers in too many aspects of routine ship-wide functioning, so Volyova said. When he used to go into one of his catatonic states, it was like pulling the plug on the entire ship. That hasn't happened. The ship's still taking care of itself, keeping itself ticking over, indulging in self-repair and the occasional upgrade.
Clavain nodded. Then it's as if the captain's still functioning on an involuntary level, but there's no sentience there anymore. Like a patient who still has enough brain function to breathe, but not much else.
That's our best guess. But we can't be totally sure. Sometimes there are little glimmers of intelligence, things that the ship does to itself without asking anyone. Flashes of creativity. It's more as if the captain's still there, but buried more deeply than was ever the case before.
Or perhaps he just left behind a ghost of himself, Clavain said, a mindless shell, pottering through the same behavioral patterns.
Whatever it was, he redeemed himself, Felker said. He did something terrible, but in the end he also saved 160,000 lives.
So did Lyle Merrick, Clavain said, remembering for the first time since he had awakened the secret within Antoinette's ship, and the necessary sacrifice the man had made.
Two redemptions for the price of one? I suppose it's a start. Clavain picked at a stray splinter of wood that had embedded itself in his palm, torn from the very edge of the tree stump. So what did happen, Felka? Why have I been awakened when everyone knew it might kill me?
I'll show you, she said. She looked in the direction of the waterfall.
Startled, for he had been certain that they were alone, Clavain saw a figure standing on the very edge of the lake immediately before the waterfall. The mist ebbed and swirled around the figure's extremities. But he recognized her.
Skade, he said.
Clavain, she answered, but she did not step closer. Her voice had been hollow, the acoustics all wrong for the environment. Clavain realized, with a jolt of irritation at how easily he had been fooled, that he was being addressed by a simulation.
She's a beta level, isn't she? He said, talking only to Felka. The Master of Works would have retained a good enough working memory of Skade to put a beta level aboard any of the other ships.
She's a beta level, yes, Felka said. But that isn't how it happened. Is it, Skade?
The figure was crested and armored. It nodded.
This beta level is a recent version, Clavain. My physical counterpart transmitted it to you during the engagement.
Sorry, Clavain said, shaking his head. My memory may not be what it was, but I remember killing your counterpart. I destroyed Nightshade shortly after I rescued Felka.
That's what you remember.
It's almost what happened, too. You can't have survived, Skade.
He said it with numb insistence, despite the evidence of his eyes.
I saved my head, Clavain.
I feared that you would destroy Nightshade once I gave you back Felka, even though I didn't think you would have the courage to do it when you knew I had Galliano aboard. She smiled, her expression strangely close to admiration.
I was wrong about that, wasn't I?
You were a far more ruthless adversary than I had ever imagined, even after you did this to me.
You had Galliano's body. Not Galliano.
Clavain held his voice steady.
All I did was give her the peace she should have had when she died all those years ago.
But you don't really believe that, do you?
You always knew she was not really dead, but merely in a state of deadlock with the wolf. That was as good as death.
But there was always the chance the wolf could be removed, Clavain.
Her voice became soft.
You believed that, too.
You believed there was a chance you could have her back one day. I did what I had to do, he said.
It was ruthlessness, Clavain. I admire you for it. You're more of a spider than any of us.
He stood up from the stump and made his way to the water's edge, until he was only a few meters from Skade. She hovered in the mist, neither fully solid nor fully anchored to the ground.
I did what I had to do, he repeated. It was all I ever did. It wasn't ruthlessness, Skade. Ruthlessness implies that I felt no pain when I did it.
And did you?
It was the worst thing I have ever done. I removed her love from the universe.
I feel sorry for you, Clavain.
How did you survive, Skade?
She reached up and fingered the curious collar where armor joined flesh.
After you left with Felka, I detached my head and placed it inside a small warhead casing. My brain tissue was buffered by integlial medicines to withstand rapid deceleration.
The warhead was ejected backwards from Nightshade, back towards the other elements of the fleet. You never noticed because you were concerned only with the prospect of an attack against yourselves. The warhead fell through space silently, until it was well beyond your detection sphere. Then it activated a focused homing pulse. One element of the fleet was delegated to change velocity until an intercept was feasible. The warhead was captured and brought aboard the other ship. She smiled and closed her eyes.
The late Dr. Delmar was aboard another fleet vessel. Unfortunately, it happened to be the ship you destroyed. But before his death, he was able to finish the cloning of my new body.
Neural reintegration was surprisingly easy, Clavain.
You should try it one day.
Clavain almost stumbled on his words.
Then you are whole again?
Yes.
She said it tartly, as if the subject was a matter for mild regret.
Yes, I am whole again now.
Then why do you choose to manifest this way?
As a reminder, Clavain, of what you made of me.
I am still out there, you see. My ship survived the engagement. There was damage, yes, just as there was damage to your ship. But I haven't given up. I want what you have stolen from us. He turned back to Felka, who was still watching patiently from her wooden stump.
Is this true? Is Skade still out there?
We can't know for sure, she said. All we know is what this beta level tells us. It could be lying, trying to destabilize us. But in that case, Skade must have shown astonishing foresight to create it in the first place.
And the surviving ships?
That's sort of why we woke you. They are out there. We have fixes on their flames even now. And then she told him that the three conjoiner ships had streaked past at half the speed of light relative to Nostalgia for Infinity, just as the simulations had predicted. Weapons had been deployed, their activation sequences as carefully choreographed as the individual explosions in a fireworks performance. The conjoiners had used particle beams and heavy relativistic railguns for the most part. Infinity had fired back with lighter versions of the same armaments, while also deploying two of the salvaged cache weapons. Both sides made much use of decoys and feints, and in the most critical phase of the engagement, savage accelerations were endured as the ships tried to deviate from predicted flight paths. Neither side had been able to claim victory. One conjoiner ship had been destroyed and damage wrought on the other two. But Clavain considered this almost as close to failure as having inflicted no damage at all. Two enemies were almost as dangerous as three. And yet the outcome could have been so much worse. Nostalgia for Infinity had sustained some damage, but not enough to prevent it from making it to another solar system. None of the occupants had been hurt, and none of the critical systems had been taken out. But we're not home and dry, Felka said.
Clavain turned from Skade's image. We're not.
The two ships that survived? They're turning around. Slowly but surely they're sweeping back around to chase us.
Clavain let out a laugh. But it'll take them light years to make the turn.
It wouldn't if they had inertia suppression technology. But the machinery must have been damaged during the engagement. That doesn't mean they can't repair it again, however. She looked at Skade, but the image made no reaction. It was as if she had become a statue poised at the water's edge, a slightly macabre decorative feature of the glade.
If they can, they will, Clavain said.
Felka agreed. The Triumvirate ran simulations. Under certain assumptions, we can always outrun the pursuing ships, at least in our reference frame, for as long as you care to specify. We just have to keep crawling closer and closer to the speed of light. But that isn't much of a solution in my book.
It isn't in mine either.
Anyway, it doesn't happen to be practical. We do need to stop to make repairs, and sooner rather than later. That's why we woke you, Clavain. Clavain walked back to the tree stumps. He lowered himself onto his with a crick of leg joints.
If there's a decision to be taken, there must be some choices on the table. Is that the case?
Yes. He waited patiently, listening to the soothing white noise hiss of the waterfall.
Well?
Felka spoke with a reverent hush.
We're a long way out, Clavain. The Resurgium system is 9 light-years behind us, and there isn't another settled colony for 15 light-years in any direction. But there's a solar system dead ahead of us. 2 cool stars. It's a wide binary, but one of the stars has formed planets in stable orbits. They're mature, at least 3 billion years old. There's one world in the habitable zone that has a couple of small moons. Indications are that it has an oxygen atmosphere and a lot of water. There are even chlorophyll bands in the atmosphere.
Clavain asked, human terraforming?
No. There's no sign of human presence ever having established itself around these stars, which leaves only one possibility, I think.
The pattern jugglers.
She was evidently pleased that it did not need to be spelled out. We always knew we'd stumble on more juggler worlds as we moved further out into the galaxy. We shouldn't be surprised to find one now.
Dead ahead. Just like that.
It isn't dead ahead, but it's close enough. We can slow down and reach it. If it's anything like the other juggler worlds, there may even be dry land. Enough to take a few settlers.
How many is a few?
Felka smiled. We won't know until we get there, will we? Clavain made his decision. It was, in truth, little more than a blessing on the obvious choice, and then returned to sleep. There were few medics amongst his crew, and almost none of them had received formal training beyond a few hasty memory uploads. But he trusted them when they said that he could not expect to survive more than one or two further cycles of freezing and thawing. "But I'm an old man," he told them. "If I stay warm, I probably won't survive that way either." "It'll have to be your choice," they told him unhelpfully. He was getting old, that was all. His genes were very antiquated, and though he had been through several rejuvenation programs since leaving Mars, they had only reset a clock, which then proceeded to start ticking again. Back on the Mother Nest, they could have given him another half-century of virtual youth, had he wished, but he had never taken that final rejuvenation. The will had never been there after Galliana's strange return and her even stranger half-death. He did not even know if he regretted it now. If they had been able to limp to a fully equipped colony world, somewhere that hadn't yet been ravaged by the melding plague, there might have been hope for him. But what difference would it have made? Galliana was still gone. He was still old inside his skull, still seeing the world through eyes that were yellow and weary with 400 years of war. He had done what he could, and the emotional burden had cost him terribly, and he did not think he had the energy to do it one more time. It was enough that he had not totally failed this time. And so he submitted to the reefer sleep casket for the final time. Just before he went under, he authorized a tight-beam laser transmission back to the dying Resurgam system. The message was one-time pad-coded for zodiacal light. If the other ship hadn't been totally destroyed, there was a chance it would intercept and decode the signal. It would never be seen by the other conjoiner ships, and even if Skade's forces had somehow managed to sow receivers through Resurgam space, they would not be able to crack the encryption. The message was very simple. It told Remontoir, Curry, Thorn, and the others that had gone with them that they were to slow and stop in the pattern juggler system. They would wait there for 20 years. That was enough time to allow zodiacal light to rendezvous with them. It was also enough time to establish a self-sustaining colony of a few tens of thousands of people, a hedge against any future catastrophe that might befall the ship. Knowing this, feeling that in some small but significant way he had put his affairs in order, Clavain slept. He woke to find that nostalgia for infinity had changed itself without consulting anyone. No one knew why. The changes were not at all apparent from within. It was only from the outside, seen from an inspection shuttle, that they became manifest. The changes had happened during the slowdown phase, as the great ship was decelerating into the new system. With the inching speed of land erosion, the rear of the ship's conic hull, normally a smaller inverted cone in its own right, had become flattened, like the base of a chess piece. No control over this transformation had been possible, and indeed, much of it had already taken place before anyone had noticed. There were vaults of the great ship that were only visited by humans once or twice a century, and much of the rear of the hull fell into that category. The machinery that lurked there had been surreptitiously dismantled or relocated further up the hull, in other disused spaces. Ilya Volyova might have noticed sooner than anyone. Not much had ever escaped Ilya Volyova. But she was gone now, and the ship had new tenants who were not yet as devoutly familiar with its territory. The changes were neither life-threatening nor injurious to the ship's performance, but they remained puzzling, and further evidence, if any were needed, that the captain's psyche had not completely vanished, and could be expected to surprise them still further at times in the future. There appeared little doubt that the captain had played some role in the reshaping of the ship he had become. The question of whether the reshaping had been consciously driven, or had merely sprung from some irrational dreamlike whim, was much harder to answer. So for the time being, because there were other things to worry about, they ignored it. Nostalgia for infinity fell into tight orbit around the watery world, and probes were sent arcing into the atmosphere and the vast turquoise oceans that nearly enclosed the world from pole to pole. Creamy cloud patterns had been dabbed on it in messy, exuberant swirls. There were no large land masses.
The visible ocean was unmarred except for a few carelessly tossed archipelagos of islands, splashes of ochre paint against corneal blue-green. The closer they had come, the more nearly certain it became that this was a juggler world, and the indications turned out to be correct. Continental rafts of living biomass, stained swathes of the ocean grey-green. The atmosphere could be breathed by humans, and there were enough trace elements in the soils and bedrocks of the islands to support self-sustaining colonies. It wasn't perfect by any means. Islands on juggler worlds had a habit of vanishing under tsunamis mediated by the great semi-sentient biomass of the oceans themselves. But for 20 years, it would suffice. If the colonists wanted to stay, they'd have time to build pontoon cities floating on the sea itself. A chain of islands, northerly, cold, but predicted to be tectonically stable, was selected. "Why there in particular?" Clavaine asked. "There are other islands at the same latitude, and they can't be any less stable."
"There's something down there," Scorpio told him. "We keep getting a faint signal from it."
Clavaine frowned.
"A signal? But no one's ever supposed to have been here."
"It's just a radio pulse. Very weak," Felka said. "But the modulation is interesting. It's conjoiner code."
"We put a beacon down here."
"We must have, at some point. But there's no record of any conjoiner ship ever coming here, except..." She paused, unwilling to say what had to be said.
"Well?"
"It probably doesn't mean anything, Clavaine. But Galliana could have come here. It's not impossible. And we know she would have investigated any juggler worlds she came across. Of course, we don't know where her ship went before the wolves found her. And by the time she made it back to the Mother Nest, all on-board records were lost or corrupted. But who else could have left a conjoiner beacon?"
"Anyone who was operating covertly. We don't know everything that the closed council got up to, even now."
"I thought it was worth mentioning, that's all."
He nodded. He had felt a great crescendo of hope, and then a wave of sadness that was made all the deeper by what had preceded it. Of course she had not been here. It was stupid of him even to entertain the thought. But there was something down below that merited investigation, and it was sensible to locate their settlement near the item of interest. He had no problem with that. Detailed plans for settlement were quickly drawn up. Tentative surface camps were established a month after their arrival. And that was when it happened. Slowly, unhurriedly, as if this were the most natural thing in the world for a 4-kilometer-long space vessel, nostalgia for infinity began to lower its orbit, spiraling down into the thin upper reaches of the atmosphere. By then it had slowed itself, too, braking to suborbital velocity, so that the friction of re-entry did not scald away the outer layer of its hull. There was panic aboard from some quarters, for the ship was acting outside of human control. But there was also a more general feeling of quiet, calm resignation about whatever was about to happen. Clavaine and the Triumvirate did not understand their ship's intentions, but it was unlikely that it meant them harm, not now. And so it proved. As the great ship fell out of orbit, it tilted, bringing its long axis into line with the vertical defined by the planet's gravitational field. Nothing else was possible. The ship would have snapped its spine had it come in obliquely, but provided it did descend vertically, lowering down through the clouds like the detached spire of a cathedral, it would suffer no more structural stress than was imposed by normal 1G starflight. Aboard, it even felt normal. There was only the dull roar of the motors, normally unheard, but now transmitted back through the hull via the surrounding medium of air, a ceaseless, distant thunder that became louder as the ship approached the ground. But there was no ground below. Though the landing site it had selected was close to the target archipelago, where the first camps had already been sighted, the ship was lowering itself towards the sea.
"My God," Clavaine thought.
Suddenly he understood why the ship had remade itself. It, or whatever part of the captain remained in charge, must have had this descent in mind from the moment the nature of the watery planet became clear. It had flattened the spike of its tail to allow itself to rest on the seabed. Down below,
The sea began to boil away under the assault of the drive flames. The ship descended through mountains of steam, billowing tens of kilometers into the stratosphere. The sea was a kilometer deep under the touchdown point, for the bed sloped sharply away from the archipelago's edge. But that kilometer hardly mattered. When Clavain felt the ship keel, coming to rest with a tremendous deep groan, most of it was still above the surface of the roiling waves. On a nameless, waterlogged world on the ragged edge of human space, under dual suns, nostalgia for infinity had landed.